Every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man. They've given you a number and taken away your name.
Joining us now is Carl Colby, a director and producer and an award-winning documentary filmmaker who has made films on subjects such as Franz Kline, William de Kooning, Bob Marley, Frank Gehry, George Jarrell, and Franco Zeffirelli. His latest film, a feature-length documentary, is about his father, the man nobody knew, In Search of My Father, CIA spymaster William Colby. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Colby.
Thank you, Ian.
And your documentary, feature-length documentary that you made about your father is really more than it's an extraordinary personal story about growing up and having this mysterious father. But the heart of the story is a huge story about the post-war role of intelligence and, of course, culminating in the Vietnam War. And then the whole expose that followed that, where your father testified endlessly before the church committee and other committees. There's a new book out now by Hank Crumpton that suggests that the entire culture of the CIA was affected by what happened with those hearings, and that a significant percentage of the American elite from whom the CIA had drawn its initial recruits turned against the war and against the intelligence community. Do you think it is a different CIA as a result of that era?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the initial CIA, you know, came out of OSS, and my father was on the sort of paramilitary side of OSS, Jedburgh, you know, parachuting into occupied France and Norway and working with local resistance leaders to, you know, combat the Nazis. And so it's very romantic, and in some ways, you know, sad to say, but maybe a bit simplistic. You know, you go in and you into an area which is being occupied by Nazis, and obviously they were not native to France or native to Norway, so you might get the support of the local populace quite more readily than you would, obviously, if you're paratrooping into North Vietnam and you're saying that you're in support of South Vietnamese. Well, they're all Vietnamese. And so it certainly is colored in the early days by OSS. And then the mid-period, I think, that you're talking about, those hearings really did affect it, because they were sort of turned into kind of a bloodletting of the CIA right around my father's period, and he was asked to fire hundreds of senior officers, and Nixon really distrusted the CIA. He thought they were a bunch of pointy-headed kind of liberal intellectuals all having cocktails in Georgetown and coming up with theories and not really doing what the president wants. And it's quite explicit, and it comes across quite frankly in the film, that Nixon really thought the CIA worked for him, I mean, directly, and tried to implicate them in, obviously, the Watergate break-in, and really thought of them as their own tool, which then the CIA and my father, but particularly Richard Helms and Vernon Walters, who was the deputy at the time, really pushed away from that idea. And I think the result of that was quite strange, because then you ended a period, really, in the 70s and 80s when, you know, America had been defeated in the Vietnam War. The mood in America was really quite against, you know, covert action. And so you almost had also the kind of professionalization of being a spy. You know, the romantic notion, the Harry Lime, that sort of character disappeared, and suddenly you had a fellow who, you know, was taking his kids to soccer practice and still reporting at headquarters every day for a job. Well, it's not really a desk-type job. And now you see the impulse to go back, really, in the CIA to the more OSS spirit. And I think that's where you're also getting a quite interesting, almost ironic mix of, rather than the CIA becoming militarized, it's as if the Pentagon and the military is becoming more intelligence-driven and much more special operations-focused. I mean, look at what we're doing now in the Horn of Africa and in Afghanistan and all. You know, we don't have these big standing armies, or at least we're trying to rid ourselves of it. You know, we have these special operation groups going in and doing things. We're doing using a lot of drones. I mean, this administration is more active in that program than any other combined. So it's a quite interesting shift, really. And so you do have a military man, Petraeus, going in to run CIA. But the more interesting mix would be to look at how the military itself is operating like an intelligence operation. They know the American public won't support large ground wars, and so we're now engaged in an awful lot of precision targeting and that sort of thing. But the big question you might ask, or certainly the politicians should be asking, is, number one, you know, morally and legally, should we even be doing this sort of thing? And number two is, what does it mean in the long run? I mean, if you can eliminate a few characters here and there, even Mr. Rodriguez, the CIA head of special operations, the other day was on television saying, so it was bad to torture Al-Qaeda but not to kill them? I mean, now we're killing them. So it's a conundrum. It's a difficult mix we're in right now, and I think it's... Sure. We could use a lot more dialogue.
Well, but Carl Colby, Rodriguez, of course, is refuted by the people who actually did the torturing in the case of Ali Soufran at the FBI and Glenn Carl at the CIA. Both have gone public saying the whole program was a complete and absolute disaster and there was no actionable intelligence. And in Glenn Carl's case, he was in charge of a black site where they had supposedly the number three Al-Qaeda guy. And from day one, he knew he was the wrong guy. And as he kept telling headquarters, which is Rodriguez, and they're operating on a finding, which is John Yoo's letter, no presidential finding, just this letter from John Yoo. Carl kept saying, we got the wrong guy. And they said, no, he's just avoiding. You've got to enhance the interrogation. Mm-hmm. And they kept this guy chained in a cellar for like 6 years, I think. And finally, mm-hmm. when Obama came in, they let him loose. And of course, he was completely innocent. And you know the price we paid around the world. So it sort of leads you to what's going on now is these different versions of histories. The neocons are promoting Rodriguez and Hank Crumpton, who was on CNN blaming Clinton for everything and not Bush.
Right.
And then you have the people like Glenn Carl and Ali Soufran doing the opposite. So
it's a lot of, recriminations aside. I mean, I think what it really calls to mind is, why aren't we having this dialogue? I mean, Senator Patrick Leahy, I interviewed him, and it's in the extra scenes of the DVD, and he says, what are we afraid of? I mean, in a sense, what are we American people afraid of? If we don't like a program, if we feel it's immoral or illegal, we shouldn't do it and live with the consequences and really conduct ourselves as Americans. And yet you don't see this, you don't feel this, and you don't sense any outrage. You certainly sense it in the American public and in the media with you and people like other very perceptive, dogged reporters and journalists, but you don't see it as much in the halls of Congress. You seem sort of more of an accepting atmosphere, and yet you wonder, is this going to be really to our detriment later when this precision sort of killing, what does it lead to ultimately? I mean, I guess it leads to just a sense of being kind of a vigilant policeman, but forever. What is the goal? And it's not really being sold to the American people. It's not being, I don't think, explained very well by the administration or any administration as to, what's the end game here.
Again, I'm speaking with Carl Colby, who has made this new feature-length documentary, The Man Nobody Knew, In Search of My Father, CIA Spymaster William Colby. You mentioned earlier Nixon's suspicion of the CIA, and he wanted to have his own personal police force. Incidentally, he did. That's why he created the Drug Enforcement Administration.
That's why Elvis, I guess, is in the Oval Office.
Right. But,
there's another good book out now, as you know, Tim Weiner's Enemies book, which is quite interesting on the history of the FBI. But it is fascinating, why are we not having this larger dialogue and how dangerous it can be in the hands of the wrong president or, frankly, any president, to have this, in a sense, secret army and unaccountable to anyone else. And you might wonder, why is our oversight process maybe not a little bit more strict? I do hear, though, that the Senate and the House, the one thing they seem to agree on is intelligence now. They seem to blend well. I mean, what I know of and I've spoken to the staff directors on the different intelligence groups, committees, and they seem to blend well. They seem to work well, even though they're controlled by different political parties. I think there's a sense that in foreign affairs and military affairs, there seems to be a growing sort of consensus, and yet I still feel that there's not a real vocal dialogue, on these issues. And
well, but it's worth pointing out, Carl Colby, that it was your father's testimony that resulted in the formation of the oversight committees in both the Senate and the House.
Yeah, I mean, ways, I'd like to actually, I often ask audiences, and it'd be great, if people see the DVD, you know, they can ask themselves the questions as to, you know, did he do the right thing? I mean, did he follow his conscience, and or is he naive? Is he just wrong-headed? How can you possibly have a secret organization and have any openness at all, have any oversight at all? And it's fascinating. Even personal friends or colleagues of his would say to him, you know, you're giving. I read a recent biography of Richard Helms, and Helms just vilified him at the end, saying, my father was just giving away the store. He was telling Congress things that nobody needed to tell them. And yet, I think my father felt he was, if he had to be loyal to one thing, it had to be the U.S. Constitution. It couldn't be the president, particularly one who was disgraced.
Well, but your personal story is so extraordinary, though, that, you know, you grow up in these countries like Italy, and you see your father leaving with briefcases full of cash and a whole bunch of cardinals or bishops from the Vatican hanging out of the house and trying to put it all together about what's going on. And then, 30, 40 years later, you find out what was really going on?
Right. Yeah, no, it was very exciting. In some ways, I didn't really want to know some things earlier on. And then I thought, well, the hell with it. You know, get to the bottom of it as much as you can.
So your father died in a very dramatic way. And again, his death led to a lot of conspiracy theories because he was out paddling his canoe and on the Chesapeake, and there were all kinds of theories, even Russians, you know, frogmen nabbing him,
right,
and all this kind of stuff. The film has still a little bit of ambivalence about what happened there. Can you walk us through that again?
Well, I can walk you through one sense, is that I think he was he had felt that I think he wasn't in a position to give any secrets out anymore. I mean, he certainly had enemies. You know, the North Vietnamese really did not care for him. The Russians, I think, that had, you know, those were professionals. I mean, I talked to Oleg Kalugin a few weeks ago, and he, you know, once again, he told me he didn't see anything that the Russians would have been doing with
sure.
him.
Sure. Let me just mention that Oleg Kalugin, General Kalugin, was the resident, the top KGB guy in Washington for decades, and he came over originally as a Fulbright scholar, but I know him well. He's a good, interesting fellow.
Right. I think it was more of a sense of I would call him, and I actually called him once, my dad, and said, and he was rambling a bit, you know, and I think he was sort of trying to connect in some way, you know. Not that I didn't speak to him, I mean, I would speak to him, but more curt sort of conversation. And he was searching and asking about, you know, had he done enough for my sister, you know, when she was ill, and just really almost like a summing up or an accounting, you know, personal accounting that you take of your own life. And you know, he was getting on a bit. I mean, 76 years old, it's not very old. But and then he said to me that, one of your friends, one of your old college buddies, was found under a bridge. He has advanced Alzheimer's and slept for the night under a bridge. And my father said, oh, well, that will never happen to me. And I said, oh, really? He says, yep. He says, one day you'll just hear that I was walking on a goat path along a Greek island and I fell to the sea. And I said, really? He said, yep, just like that. It's as if he wouldn't go quietly. And if he was going to go, he'd rather control it. I mean, if any of us think about our life, I mean, do you want to go in some untoward moment? I mean, are you... It's as if he... I'm not saying he planned his own demise, but I think he had a sense, or at least when it came upon him, I think he knew. And I think there was always a control factor in him. I think he was very disturbed by being thrown out of the CIA when he was. I think that really upset his whole, just his whole being, really. He had been this ultimate company man, and they had done everything they'd ever asked him to do, taken every dirty assignment thrown at him, and then they throw him out for telling the truth, you know, for really being the good American. Mm. And I think it was a little bit too much.
Well, you know, I work with your father on, of all things, the California nuclear freeze. You recall during the Reagan administration, they weren't talking to the Russians, and the nuclear freeze movement resulted from a great deal of concern that the nuclear arms race were getting out of hands, and the Russians and the Americans weren't talking. And he made commercials for me
right,
to promote the nuclear freeze, and he was motivated by having been in the CIA and known about stuff that's still secret to this day, about the many near misses that we had in the nuclear age. And the idea that you have a nuclear war on purpose is pretty insane.
Right.
But to have a nuclear war by accident, and he was absolutely convinced that one of these days, one of these damn things were going to go off because the controls simply weren't sufficient. And it's so interesting in retrospect that that argument is still going on. You know, just yesterday, General Cartwright, and the former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs and head of the U.S. nuclear forces, has called for a reduction down to 900 of nuclear weapons.
Right, I read that. And it's fascinating also that, let's say, George Shultz and Henry Kissinger and Bill Perry and Sam Nunn have all, you know, signed up for really, you know, the
zero nuclear weapons.
Ridding ourselves of nuclear weapons. I mean, it's quite interesting. You know, these are these ultimate power players. And yet, I think as they get older, they realize, as you say, they've had privileged information to see how many near misses or how sloppy some of these armaments may have been handled, particularly by the other side, and how, again, something could have slipped through the cracks. I mean, something could have been sold to somebody in the Ukraine, and God help us, you know. So I think there's really more of a sense of mortality and of how slipshod it all was. And also, I think these men and some women are really... they're very disturbed by sort of warmongering. They're very disturbed by the idea, oh, let's launch. You know, like, you don't hear that word shock and awe anymore. You know, that kind of idea that, oh, well, we'll just go out and obliterate the enemy and it'll all be wonderful and it'll be over. We don't. Those conflicts don't exist anymore.
Sure.
And thank God we don't have people like that in office who are controlling things.
Well, Carl Colby, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Carl Colby. He's a director, producer, and award-winning documentary filmmaker who's made films about such subjects as Franz Kline, William de Kooning, Bob Marley, Frank Gehry, George Harrell, and Franco Zeffirelli. His latest film, a feature-length documentary, is about his father, the man nobody knew, In Search of My Father, CIA spymaster William Colby. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Christian Vasquez. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.